Okay, ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I think after we had our ethics session, now we look at the other side, which is the responsibility of science and the urgent need for science in the implementation of the 2030 Sustainable Development Agenda. Now, as we all know, that the 2030 Agenda and the Sustainable Development Goals have defined an ambitious action plan for the future that we want, but they say little about implementation. The recently concluded 2019 high-level political forum that took place in New York in July has revealed that member countries are not yet on track to achieve the SDGs by 2030. But at the same time, the same meeting has also demonstrated that there is still time to change course and save the situation, as indicated by Ms. Rhonda King, the ex-president of UN ECOSOC. Now, the universality of the agenda requires that every country, okay, and that is developing as well as developed countries, have at its disposal the necessary science and technology to devise the transformative pathways to respond to its specific characteristic needs and priorities. Last September, the UN Global Sustainable Development Report came out and has acknowledged that significant gaps remain for bridging the scientific and technological divide between the developed and developing countries. In this session, what we're trying to do is to bring perspectives of a number of UN mechanisms, national senior and young academies, and the scientific community to provide us with a clear or a more clear picture about what mechanisms are now in place and or need to be established and developed to address the challenges of science for sustainable development, and how to strengthen STI for the timely implementation of the SDGs. We have five presenters that will try to answer questions like, what needs to be practically done to ensure more even global distribution of scientific capacity and knowledge access in a timely fashion? The stress here is urgency and timely fashion. How are countries in the developing world expected to devise the thought transformative pathways, bearing in mind their relatively low capacities and huge fund gaps that they have? Who will bear the hefty investment bill towards the implementation of the SDGs? And what can science really contribute in order to facilitate the realization of the co-benefits as well as resolving the trade-offs between the SDGs? With that introduction, I would call upon my first presenter, Dr. Eva Fuhrman. She will be presenting about the highlights and SDI recommendations for the UN Global Sustainable Development Report. Dr. Eva is a member of the group of independent scientists that were responsible for writing the report. She is the director of the Environment Policy Center within the Finnish Environment Institute and chair of Finland's Sustainable Development Expert Panel and a member of delegations of Finland to the High-Level Political Forum in 2019, among others. Dr. Eva, please, you have the floor.
Thank you very much, and it's, I think, a great pleasure to be here in this. Yeah, in this high-level forum, and I enjoyed very much this morning session as well, and it gave me many thoughts because, as we know, the 2030 agenda is an ethical agenda, and we could start by asking that if we are in an airplane, I suppose quite many of us came here with the airplane, and if someone gets a heart attack on the airplane, they call upon, is there a doctor, is there a medical doctor on the plane? And someone has to weigh whether they are going on a holiday somewhere to Bahamas in their shorts. And the same way, I suppose, if we see that this world needs to transform in a knowledge-based way, then I think if the world has challenges as we have at the moment with our development, we also call upon scientists. So this ethical issue and responsibility of scientists is not only not to do something and not to stay away from something novel, but also to take the responsibility and actually maybe do research in a different way. So now I go to my presentation. I was just so kind of excited about the morning. So as we started the Sustainable Development Goals 17, the progress has been very slow, and for many of the SDGs, actually the development has been negative. And the four that I have here on the slide, rising inequalities, biodiversity loss, climate change, and growing amount of waste are issues that hamper the whole sustainable development framework to develop further. So the first point that I want to raise is that the different SDGs are highly interlinked, and if we are basing our work moving ahead with single SDGs, we don't really lead anywhere. This is a study that we made in this group on looking at the interlinkages of the different SDGs, and you can find this on the internet, but basically the message is that very, very little knowledge is about the interlinkages, and with that I mean that if we enhance one SDG, how does it affect the others? So the size of the circle shows how much knowledge there is on global level. So you need to see there's a lot of white. The other message is that there's a lot of blue, which means that there's a lot of co-benefits of pushing one SDG ahead. You can at the same time take another SDG forward. But the orange colors are the worrying ones. They are the ones that we should really pay attention to beforehand. And those are the trade-offs that cause people to get on the roads and affect injustice in our societies. But we have other issues as well that are linked with when we implement the SDGs, and that's the hyper-connectiveness of our world. We have always learned that there is globalization, whether it's good or bad. Today it just is, and it has happened so fast during the last, let's say, 20 years that we haven't, and the way that our economies have been developed, it has not led to flows that are equal or for humanity or for the nature. And then the third dimension that makes it very difficult is that we have challenges, or both the challenges as well as the solutions or the way forward are very much affected by several actors, not only scientists and not only policymakers. And usually we talk about those that are losing something, but in reality we have a lot of stakes that actually benefit from today's situation. And here we have the table on the left-hand side which shows all those that are really doing high revenues today. And they are countries, and they are industries, and there's industries that are really causing lots of problems, for example, with climate change. So with these issues in our mind, we came to the conclusion in the group writing the report that actually we are not able to tackle the single SDGs as such, but we need to take a broader systemic approach. And if we tackle the six, we can divide the kind of societal systems into six different ones. And if we are able to transform all these six systems simultaneously or at the same time, not prioritizing any of them, we are actually able to move forward. And these six actually draw all the 17 SDGs into them. So we don't need to develop a new agenda, but the political agenda is the SDGs. But when we take it, when we implement it to the society, we need much concrete things to actually take some grip of them. So that's human well-being and capabilities, sustainable and just economies, the way that we consume and produce things, sustainable food systems and healthy nutrition patterns, energy decarbonization, but also access to energy, clean energy, and then the urban and peri-urban development to move that for a sustainable path. And then more than anything is the global environmental commons to secure those for the benefit of everything. The second very key point links with those. How we push these transformations is something where we need not only one lever and not only four levers, but we need the four levers to be in an integrated way so that they push the transformations to the same direction. And those are the governance, the policies, and the public sector. It's the economy and finance, the investing. Individual and collective action, and then the role of science and technology. And this is really crucial because together they can build a path which takes to the direction of sustainable development. It looks very complicated, but this is much more concrete, much more embedded in our society than tackling technocratically the different ones. And different countries are in different situations, so they need to build the levers in their own way, how it serves the best way the society, their societies. So now I would like to move to the next issue, is the science. Because this is something dealing with the systems, we really need a lot of emphasis on or help from science to do this. And to be able to do that is that we need to move towards sustainability science on a universal space. And today the situation is not the same issue. So if we think about today's situation, every 1,000th person in the world is a scientist. Have you imagine of that? But the difference between the developed and the non-developed world and the low and middle income countries is very different. In the OECD countries, we have 3,500 researchers per million habitats, when again in the poor countries, it's about 70. And for example, Africa produces only 2% of the science that is produced worldwide. And the second problematic issue that actually came with someone's comment in the plenary this morning was that 60% of world science is funded actually by private sector. And that is for the benefit of these companies, it's understandable. And now when we need these systemic changes, there's a really mismatch of that. And when we are talking about these difficult systemic changes, or whether they are difficult or not, I would say that they are quite difficult. We can look at the sphere of what kind of problems we need to deal with sustainable development. And most of them are actually these wicked problems that are actually only partly with factual certainty and only partly with sociopolitical agreement. And those are really difficult ones. And someone was talking in the morning about these vaccines. And when we are dealing with vaccines, we can't deal them as simple problems by bringing the knowledge that the vaccines are important and so forth. We need to take the whole wicked issue and tackle with that, and that is sustainability science. So we, author of this paper, we at the same time as this report was given to the presidents of all the nations, we published in the Nature Sustainability Journal published our paper, which is on sustainability science. And there we really emphasize that what the move to sustainable development requires is that we firstly need to understand these systemic interactions. And there we need all different disciplines to come up and help with that. Second point that we need is to understand that there are competing agendas. I showed you that today's situation, there's many who actually are benefiting from that. And that is the friction that we have. And also in the injustice, we know that it's not only injustice in money, it's mainly injustice in political situations. Who has the power to affect the political decisions? So we need to understand who has the power to make the transformation or to make friction to it. And then the third one, with this knowledge, to co-create together with the societies these transformations. And this is the new type where we need to work together and bring our understanding, our high knowledge from the research into the discussions and bring it into the practical level, concrete level in different places. And so here are the recommendations from the report. So firstly, these assessments that we have, the IPCC and IPBS, and now this report, we need to have these more to help the decision makers to bring the existing knowledge together, and they need to be in somehow coherent, not to get the policymakers totally lost in their heads. We need to have these SDG knowledge platforms and continue with the knowledge diplomacy. And here we use the word knowledge diplomacy, not science diplomacy. I was so happy yesterday to join one of these sessions. And then we need these novel partnerships so that we can also take the business community on board. The second one is very much to boost the scientific knowledge in the low and middle income countries. I was so happy, I will just finish. I was so happy to hear about UNESCO, about the open access, but it's very broad issue of access to science. And we need these science knowledge technology platforms in different countries and also to collaborate among the countries, and to build the science capacity, curricula and education, and also the scientific funding institution in all parts of the world. And the precautionary measures need to be taken even though we are not on board as yet. So finally, I would like to say that the key issue is make a moonshot on sustainability sciences. Because of these flows that go around the world, it's not enough that we know how the global systems work. We also need to understand the context-specific ones, and that's why we need science capacity everywhere in the world. It's not only an ethical question, it's also a practical question, because sustainable development is reached only if all countries are on board. So I thank you very much for your attention here and looking forward for the discussion.
Thank you very much, Dr. Eva, for this presentation. I couldn't agree more that sustainable development is a wicked problem. It's ill-defined, complex, but we all know that optimization methods are well established, and I think the scientific community can find ways and means to actually resolve it, but it has to be a time-bound solution. Now I go to my second speaker and topic. We are going to be talking about more about policy making, taking examples like the UN Technology Facilitation mechanism. We all know that technological innovations has long been recognized as crucial to achieving development objectives. But scaling up applications of existing scientific knowledge and technological innovation in both the natural and social sciences while pursuing further research can enable shifts away from the business as usual and to identify and address obstacles to widespread deployment and technology transfer. My next speaker, Dr. Heidi Heckman, she is the CEO of the International Science Council and a member of the United Nations Technology Facilitation Mechanism. She has actually been the executive director of the two organizations that merged in July 2018 to form the International Science Council. Basically, they were the International Council for Science and the International Social Science Council, and she has been the executive director for eight years. Dr. Heckman is a distinguished fellow of the International Institute of Applied Systems Analysis in Austria and a member of several international advisory committees and boards. She is a member and a past co-chair of the UN's 10-member group supporting the technology facilitation mechanism on sustainable development goals. Dr. Heckman, the floor is yours. Let me see if I can get that quickly. This one, right?
That's it. Thank you. Great. Thank you very much for that kind introduction. I should also add Dr. Heckman has food poisoning. So if I need to leave the room, I apologize in advance. It's something bad I ate last night. Colleagues, so I first want to say, Ava, thank you for the introduction to the GSDR. I think it's a terrific report. Congratulations to you and the team once again. And I think what I want to reflect on today ties in nicely with this notion of transformative science. It strikes me that in the last 3-4 years, you know, I spend my life going from one meeting, be it an advisory committee or a project meeting, workshops, seminars, where we repeat the same mantras about, you know, the transformative and nature of the SDGs, the fact that STI, science, technology, and innovation, is absolutely key to the successful implementation of the SDGs, that there's a lot of knowledge out there, that the international science community is ready, is rallying, that funders are getting behind the agenda. And yet we know that we're off track. We're far from meeting the goals. So critical for the work of the ISC and for many other organizations here in the room is this issue of what is it then that we need to do to better mobilize, align, coordinate, drive successfully science that supports the implementation and speeds up the implementation of the SDGs. And I worry that we're trapped in coming up with the same answers. So what I want to do today, yes, I will tell you about the technology facilitation mechanism, but then I want to just do something a little bit broader than that and say, how do we need to think about this problem of, because what we're essentially talking about is that science, policy, practice interface. And how do we get that right? Because that's what we want to promote. So, on the technology facilitation mechanism, first thing to say is, despite its name, this really is about science and technology for innovation and for SDGs. It's not a mechanism. Bill, I'm happy to see you. Hello. Who was co-chair with me of the 10-member group when this initiative was launched in 2015. And Bill, I think it's fair to say the focus here is not simply on technology.
It's not only on science, and one of the problems we have, of course, is understanding the science, technology, innovation as a package, be that as it may. The technology facilitation mechanism was created 2015, and what is interesting, it was created, called for, and established by member states. It essentially has three components. Every year, there is a Science, Technology, and Innovation Forum held in New York at headquarters, and this is an annual multi-stakeholder event where the science, technology, and innovation community, broadly defined, gets to interact with member states. That has happened five times now, so that part of the TFM, that component of the TFM, is well established, and many of you have, I know, have been to those fora. The second component, there was an idea that we would establish an online platform that would provide a gateway to policymakers, to member states, and a knowledge base and a place for exchange of critical information about existing science, technology, and innovation initiatives that are relevant to the SDGs, relevant to the implementation of the SDGs. There's a demo model has been provided on that, but the harsh reality is, like with the TFM on the whole, there is no funding to take this forward. So that is at demo stage as not being used or utilized. The third component of the mechanism is very interesting. It's what is called the IATT, an interagency task team, and this currently brings together a group of more than 40, I think it's about 42 at the moment, UN bodies, UN agencies, programs, including UNESCO, UNEP, you name it. They're all there to provide coordination, coherence, and cooperation within the UN's discussion around STI for the SDGs. Potentially a very powerful group of bodies. And then, it's not correct to say that Bill and I are members of the TFM. We are members of an advisory group called the 10-member group. It's a multi-stakeholder advisory group, and we advise and support the IATT, essentially, in delivering on the annual STI forum and on the other work streams that the IATT has set for itself, and I will come back to one of those. That is the TFM, and in the discussion, I'm sure we can answer specific questions, technical questions about how this all works. What I wanted to say is that the TFM is a mechanism for advancing, this is my understanding, it's a mechanism for advancing the interface between science and technology, so science broadly defined, policy and practice, given its multi-stakeholder nature, given that there is outreach and engagement with private sector, with civil society, etc. So it's a mechanism. And it's an important one. And as a member of the 10-member group now for 4 years, I would say for me, having seen other mechanisms, having been involved in mechanisms, establishing them, etc., what makes this important is that within the UN system, here we have member states recognizing and calling for and profiling the key role of STI by establishing this mechanism. So there's a symbolic significance, which I think we mustn't underestimate. It might sound crazy to you, but if I think about 10 years of trying to get science mentioned in political declarations within the UN system, it is now a much easier job. We don't have to remind member states that science also has to be mentioned. It is mentioned. They ask for initiatives like the GSDR, etc. So there is a growing recognition. I think it's very important that the TFM, and particularly this annual STI forum, opens up the UN system to engagement from those from the STI community. You no longer have to go via an accredited agency or NGO. You can go to New York. You can meet with member states. You can be part of the discussions. That is also not to be underestimated. It creates access to the system for debate. The Science, Technology and Innovation Forum, some of you who've been there will realize that, oh, you come out of it and you think, oh, another talk shop. But actually, it sets agendas. It raises issues that are cross-cutting to this question of science for the SDGs. Issues around disruptive technologies, technology transfer, around building science advisory ecosystems and how to connect national and global ecosystems, agendas around STI capacity development, and that takes me to the next point. The TFM, through the work of the IATT, so through the UN agencies, this is really separate from the work of the 10-member group. It's the IATT doing this, providing concrete support and guidance to member states on some of these cross-cutting issues. And the most prominent work of the IATT has been to develop what is called the STI for SDG road mapping program. So there's an online, there's a guideline on how to do STI road mapping, and it's now being rolled out with the support of the IAT in a number of case study countries. It's an important mechanism. But it's one of many, 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 many mechanisms in the UN family and beyond. There are all sorts of commissions, departments, other structures, advisory bodies, advisors, individuals, committees, groups. There are summits, there are policy fora. There are networks like the International Network of Government Science Advisors, the Foreign Ministry's Science and Technology Advisory Network, and many others. There are projects that take on this interface challenge focused on the SDGs. Tracy, you and I were at one in London two weeks ago. Another project on how do we align science for implementation of the SDGs. These are about the interface. These are mechanisms. There are partnerships, bilateral partnerships between ISC and specific UN agencies, or ISC and IAP. We're all creating more and more structures, projects, systems, mechanisms to promote this interface. There are consultative processes like the UN Major Group System, which is also fundamental to ensuring that the voice of science is heard and visible in policy formulation and implementation processes within the UN. That's a mechanism that the International Science Council, together with the World Federation of Engineering Organization, manages. So there are many, and the TFM needs to be understood within that broader landscape of mechanisms. And so then we come to this issue that, okay, if there are so many mechanisms, why is it not working? Why do we still all feel at some level that is hard to articulate that we're not having impact? That we're always, our science events at the Climate Action Summit, the science event was a side event. What is it going to take for the science community to sit around the table with the Security Council as one measure of success of getting this interface right? So we still ask the same question. How do we better do better? How do we accelerate and amplify the contributions of science and technology to the implementation of the SDGs? So what is it about these mechanisms that are not working? And typically, and I'm speaking purely from my subjective experience here, and so I'm experimenting with this, I think we ask, this is the right question to ask, but our responses tend to go back to my previous slide. We go and build more mechanisms, or we try to improve the existing ones. We're critical of the existing ones. We say the TFM, the Science, Technology and Innovation Forum this year didn't have enough people from this sector, or we try to improve the mechanisms with technical fixes, or we build new mechanisms, and we do that. I get invited to new projects, new initiatives, which are all about asking the same question. So, I think we should not think about the science policy interface as a mechanism, as a technical issue of process and of structures. We need to think about it and understand it and approach it as a system. And this speaks right to, I think, the conclusions of the GSDR report. And very briefly, it's like any system, it's complex and it's growing in complexity. The demands for STI are growing. The locations from where those demands are coming from are increasing. The opportunities are increasing. As I said, there's more recognition, there's more visibility, so we can engage. But the challenges increase with that. There are more mechanisms, there are more voices involved, stakeholders, citizen scientists, the youth, they're all becoming engaged and they can get access. And with the increasing number of voices, you also get increasing number of decision-making cultures. So the complexity of that interface is growing. At the same, like, again, like complex systems, the key components of the system interact in multiple ways. And those ways vary across different contexts. So when we talk about science policy or science for policy and the interface, it's different whether we're talking at the global level, sitting in the UN, to talking at a local level, at a city level. It's a different understanding of the way in which those elements interact and what is required and how we foster that interface. It varies whether we're talking about policy formulation or policy implementation, different set of interactions and rules to follow. It varies whether we're talking about the use of existing knowledge or production of new knowledge. It varies whether we're talking about the science for policy push or whether we're talking about policy for science, the funding, the incentive structures, etc. And so I think we need to think about this as a system and tackle it as a system. And the components for me of the system, and I don't have time to go into this, but this is something maybe we can develop. This is where we get stuck, and it is important. The mechanisms, which essentially speaks to the different roles that science can play in promoting science for policy and practice. It speaks to the roles, not the structures. Structures aren't important. It's the roles we play. And in all those structures, we are a participant. We are an expert. We provide science on understanding the interactions. That's, you know, we're acting as experts. We are advisors. We are diplomats. We are partners, sometimes in the co-production of knowledge, sometimes in the co-production of policy. And I'm not sure whether we are advocates. Many other sectors are, but science has an issue around advocacy and what responsible advocacy in this particular case may be. So it's about understanding the roles, and I think we do then have to focus on what makes those mechanisms and those roles more effective and efficient. That's important work to do, and importantly, how do we make them more representative? How do we make them more inclusive? How do we make them more diverse? But that's not the end of the story. All of us are working on the other critical components, but we need to now begin to bring this all together. Briefly, for me, the critical conditions, none of those mechanisms and roles work unless we ensure that the science we are bringing to the decision-making table is rigorous, is relevant, and is responsible. And you could say a lot about what rigor, relevance, and responsibility is. The notion of really fostering integrated knowledge is part of the relevance. Understanding what the key priorities are is part of the relevance. And when we think about those critical conditions, our task is to ensure, again, that the critical capacities that are necessary to ensure rigorous, relevant, responsible science in all parts of the world, that those capacities are being taken care of. And then there are some levers. And I think funding is a lever. It's not. We could be more impactful as a science community on the SDGs without an additional few zeros behind the funding pot. But funding is a lever. It helps a lot. And it's critically important. But it is a lever, I think. The science system incentives, are we making it possible for scientists to play the kind of transdisciplinary engaged roles that we want them to play in the co-production of knowledge with policy and civil society? And very importantly, And I think this is something that is a huge challenge for us as a science community and also for the International Science Council, is to understand the extent to which both within the policy community and the broader public, that science is actually valued and how we promote the valuing of science. Without that, the mechanisms, they will remain talk shops. So I think we need to think about the science policy practice interface in a systemic way, like we do with everything else. And what it says to me, the challenge for the council is to ensure that that's what we're doing. And we are. We've just published our new action plan. I'd love to spend another 5 minutes giving you a PR job on that, but I don't have time for that. There are copies floating about, but suffice it to say, we do see the systemic challenge of ensuring that science now does contribute to the successful implementation of the SDGs. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Dr. Heckman, for this, I would say, inspiring presentation. It gives us a little bit of reality check, but at the same time, it does not close the doors of whether we're going to be able to make it by 2030 or not. My next speaker is going to talk on the role of national academies in the 2030 agenda implementation. Dr. Teresa Stoppler is the executive director of the Inter-Academy Partnership for Policy, which is a network of more than 140 science academies. She is also a senior program officer with the United States National Academy of Science and a member of the Global Young Academy. Please, Dr. Teresa, the floor is yours. Where is it now? Can you please? The thing sometimes disappears.
Thank you very much. So with this excellent foundation that my colleagues have built, I would like to talk about what practically the scientific community can do right now to help implement the Sustainable Development Goals, and in particular, the merit-based academies of science, engineering, and medicine. So I'll be telling you about a project that we recently completed on this topic and tried to further engage this community, an important constituent of the scientific community around the world, on this. So first, the Inter-Academy Partnership, as Nazar said, is a global network of over 140 academies, primarily science academies, but many include sections in the humanities, as well as social sciences, engineering, and medical and health. So we have four regional networks as well, covering Asia, the Americas, Europe, and Africa as part of this Inter-Academy Partnership family. And recently, we've inducted the Global Young Academy, which I'll talk about in just a second, as a member of this partnership as well, which is really important. And so the vision or the idea here is for the world's academies to play a critical role in ensuring that science serves society, and that it does that inclusively and equitably. So the way we do this is by trying to build the capacity of academies around the world, namely to provide independent, authoritative advice on scientific issues at different scales, but also through various programs in science education and in outreach. And this is in alignment with the goals generally of national academies. And so this network provides a way for academies to work together. And I'd say a major goal of IEP's work is really to ensure that lower income countries and new and less resourced academies have a seat at the table and ensure that they're part of this global scientific discourse, We think this is really important, and this actually does strengthen the science advisory mechanism at a global level. So the Inter-Academy Partnership works very closely with the Global Young Academy. I'm a member. There's actually about 40 of us here. My colleague, Javier, who you'll hear from in just a moment, is an alumnus. So this is a worldwide network of 200 individuals. It's highly multidisciplinary from over 80 countries. And this group really works together, again, to ensure science is serving society. These scholars are selected not only for their scholarly achievements, which are very important, but also for their demonstrated commitment to ensuring that their science or their scholarship serves society. And so this is a platform for early career scholarships to lead international dialogue and to gain leadership skills. So really we're developing the next generation of leadership at a global scale and mobilizing talent from across the globe. So I'll be mentioning here our project on the Sustainable Development Goals. And again, we are trying to raise awareness, particularly amongst the national academies, which are our constituents, but amongst the scientific community at large, and then critically to identify concrete ways that this scientific community can contribute to the implementation of the SDGs. And I want to recognize my colleague, Tracy Elliott, who's in the audience. She was the project director for this project, and we also have hard copies of this report and its summary, should you like to take one with you. But this was a really interesting project that we just completed. It included regional workshops around the world involving 68 senior academies and 17 young academies, as well as the Global Young Academy, looking together with policymakers on creating action plans, so concrete actions that are regionally specific at different levels about what we can do, and I'll give you some examples of that. The report was launched at the May 2019 multi-stakeholder forum, which Haida mentioned, and it focuses on academies, but again, these really translate to the broader scientific community in which we work, as well as to the UN and its agencies and other constituents. So for example, at the regional scale, we think that there could be much stronger strategic links between academies and the UN regional commissions. Nationally, to engage in the voluntary national review process. So many times the science is not front and center here, and we think that academies have a much larger role to play in their particular countries in this space. Haida also mentioned STI for SDGs road mapping exercises. So for me, this really makes sure that the SDGs are translated at the national scale into the existing national development plans in that country and making sure that we see how we can take this global framework down to the national scale. And we think academies can really play an important role in that. But it goes both ways. So we focus on the scientific community, but for the UN, the member states and the regional commissions should really try to better utilize their respective scientific communities who want to help and are looking for ways to help but don't really know how sometimes. So this could be through ensuring there's accurate reporting on progress, accounting for interactions amongst the SDGs, and strengthening weak indicators, which we know those have been identified, and then through research, plugging data gaps that may exist. And then how can you personally support the SDGs? So one thing is I think many within the scientific community still don't know a lot about the SDGs. You'd be surprised. It's growing, but you can do a lot as just to be an ambassador, just to talk about them in your work, through your networks, the conferences, the scientific conferences you go to, and really try to raise awareness of what they are and their importance. You can help review or inform your country's assessment of progress. Again, this is the voluntary national review process. 50 countries are currently set to report next year. You can see those at the website on the screen. I'd welcome you to check if yours is one of them and if there's any way you could get involved, or even after the report is out, if you could you know, check and see if is that an accurate reflection from your scientific discipline of what's really going on. Familiarize yourself with UN processes, pathways, and people, which can be complex. We've tried to break down some of that in this report, but this is really important to know, as Haida mentioned, the levers. And then look out for UN-related open calls and consultations, which could be routed through the UN Scientific and Technological Major Group, through the International Science Council and World Federation of Engineering Organizations, as well as other networks you may be a part of. So they're constantly looking for expertise and would value your inputs. And here's my contact information, and thanks very much. I look forward to our discussion.
Thank you very much, Dr. Teresa, for this account of how the science community can actually get more involved in solving the contemporary issues around the globe. My next speaker is going to talk about now the role of young scientists in the 2030 Agenda implementation, Dr. Javier Garcia Martinez. He's the director of the Molecular Nanotechnology Laboratory of the University of Alicante. He's president of the National Young Academy of Spain, president-elect of International Union for Pure and Applied Chemistry, and alumnus of the Global Young Academy. The floor is yours.
Thank you. Good morning, everybody. Thank you for coming. If you are here, it's because you have a sense of urgency. That's in the title of our session. So hopefully, I will bring that kind of sense to my presentation. And that's why I wanted to call my presentation a call action to all scientists. Not everybody's in the room. Not everybody feels the urgency. But our mission is to make sure that everybody, all scientists, and even beyond, are part of this adventure. It's really wonderful when we look at these reports from the Millennium Development Goals. Do you remember those goals? Just to remember them? Okay, so this is a call for hope. If you see how well we did, of course not perfectly, but how well we did with these 8 goals, there is room for hope. And one of my main messages is that part of this success was based on having science and technology that help to achieve these goals. We will not be very honest to ourselves if we believe that just with better science and technology we can achieve these or any other goals. But having better science and technology is key to achieve these and the new goals. And I have good news for you. Of course, from those 8 goals, we got bold and we moved to 17, still in those 15 years time frame. But we have now 118 solutions for those 17 goals. I don't know if everybody gets the joke, what the 118 is coming from. Those are the chemical elements, right? So this year we are celebrating the International Year of the Periodic Table. And this this year has been very successful, and the main theme, actually, of the International Year is how chemistry can contribute to achieving the Sustainable Development Goals. In just one of our activities, the Periodic Table Challenge, we have reached over 100,000 students for more than 120 countries in just one activity. It has been a great success because we all remember the periodic table, which, by the way, is a human construct. It's a celebration of those women and men that has been creating elements, solutions for the problems we have today. So I invite all of you to think of how to better use the scientific unions, not only IUPAC, but all our broader unions, because we are all eager to contribute. So the academies are indeed a key part of the science ecosystem, but the international unions are also very eager to help and I believe the International Year are a good opportunity to engage with a broader audience. Also, speaking from IUPAC point of view, we need to remember that chemistry has a big industry behind this science, and we have been very conscious of the role of the chemical industry in achieving the Millennium Development Goals, and we are working with them in this International Year to commit the chemical industry to achieving these goals. As Teresa was mentioning before, I was a member of the Global Jan Academy. I guess not Jan anymore. But one of the things I would like to share with you is something that maybe you don't know, but has been one of the main achievements of the Global Jan Academy, in my humble opinion, which is to seed the birth of all these national Jan Academies. Being global is great, but actually being local is also a big opportunity. And now we have more than 40 national Jan Academies all around the world, with thousands of young, very committed scientists which are really working, trying to get the Sustainable Development Goals. Actually, very early on, that was one of our main tasks. And the beauty of these Jan Academies is that they actually work with working groups, trying to achieve these goals in a very practical way. Jan scientists are in the earliest stage of their scientific careers. Of course, we want to get tenure, we want to publish, we want to develop a career, so we don't have too much time to waste. So when we meet, we usually do in working groups to achieve something very practical. I'm looking forward to the panel to talk about how we can actually be practical and achieving those kind of questions that were posing to us. And I'm very pleased also to let you know, if you were not in the room yesterday, that yesterday we launched the guiding principles of the Jan Academies, which is also very important because these thousands of Jan scientists, which are all around the world, are sharing the same principles. And the Sustainable Development Goals is at the foundations of all these 40 plus Jan Academies, which are on the ground doing practical, very specific projects. And it was almost like a foundational moment when yesterday we launched this declaration, our little constitution, what is uniting us, which I think is beautiful. And I hope you recognize during this World Science Forum how many of these young scientists from the Global Jan Academy or from the National Jan Academies are not only present, but actually also involved in the sessions. With that, let me just finish inviting you to beautiful Madrid, to my country. As you know, we are celebrating the Climate Change Conference in Madrid. It was to be hosted in Chile, but finally will be in Madrid. Our National Jan Academy is heavily involved in the organization of this major conference. Climate change is one of our major challenges for the future. One of the strengths of this conference is that it's a multi-stakeholder. We will have the decision makers there, business leaders, and of course, the scientific community. So I hope that you will make time to be in Madrid in a 2 weeks time. I know it's a very short notice. We didn't plan for this when Chile invited us, but we are doing our best to organize a wonderful conference for all of you. So with that, I just invite you to come to Madrid. You're more than welcome to come, and thank you for your kind attention. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Dr. Martinez, for showing us that young scientists actually have a role to play in the future that we all need. Okay, last but not the least, I'm inviting Professor Hazir Al-Hajj. She is a professor at the University of Science and Technology in Khartoum and a TWAS fellow to talk to us about her experience from the developing countries' perspective and how is it difficult or easy to actually set the tone for the implementation of the SDGs in those countries. Let me put your... I have 8 minutes.
Okay, good afternoon, I think now, everyone. So I'm going to share 7 years' experience working in SDGs, and mainly SDG number 7, as academia, coming from academia researcher, but also I worked with all other stakeholders to just make sure that we really implement this. So this is one of my projects that we wanted to share or to expand over all over the country, rolling out of small-scale biogas in Sudan. And this is was after Sudan faced many energy issues and the profile changed, and we have like very low electrification rate, and rural areas are mostly is the part which is suffering from this. So the first thing that we made in 2014 is to make stakeholder consultation workshops and to understand the barriers of the development of bioenergy as in the whole context and the small scale biogas in Sudan for rural areas. And this year, as the stakeholders were coming from government, from NGOs, and also from private sectors. And in this workshop, we formed our biogas research group at Sudan University of Science and Technology. So we listed the main 6 barriers that face the development or implementation and get real impact of this. Is the first thing is the big gap between academia, scientists, and government, who are the policy makers and the decision maker and other stakeholders, including private sector. So everyone is working isolated islands, so there is no real outcomes. The second thing is the absence of policies supporting the implementation of SDGs at national level. Yes, I work in SDG number 7, affordable, clean, and sustainable energy, but this is also applied for other people or researchers are working in other SDGs. SDGs and the related scientific knowledge are not part of the education system, neither in the primary or secondary schools or even at university level. So researchers in the postgraduate level, then the interest of supervisors or other will, or those who goes went outside for learning like me, they get the interest and go for this. The fourth is the weak research environment and lack of properly equipped research facilities. So how we can go for innovation and technology even we don't have the facilities that are available for doing researches. And the difficulties in communicating science with different stakeholders at national level. So when you say SDG, what SDG? So the language of science and the SDGs language all in English. Arabic is a medium language even for study or universities. So it is very difficult to communicate science with the policymakers and other people. And also the international fund supporting the implementation of SDGs is not even partially dedicated to science research and academic development. So I think I am here because I got support from different organizations like ESCOA and also like TIWAS to be outside and learn and get the experience. But for others, it is not something easy. And this is applied also for other developing countries in Africa. So the role of academia, I'm going to tell our perspective. The first thing that we decided to understand and prioritize the needs for communities and people then create value of achieving few SDGs together, like interlinkage, like we're achieving goal number 7, but at the same time we achieve also goal number 2 and number 3. So in this regard, we have, for example, when I say rolling biogas for rural areas, I'm speaking of the suffering of women. This is the women in my rural areas. So they are struggling to collect wood fuel from far places. And also they are responsible to cook. So this is all in the head of the woman at all ages. So this doesn't matter if it's old woman or young woman. So they are all working in this. And this is, yes, they provide fuel for their food, for cooking, but also they contribute to the deforestation in the country, which is going in high level. So this is the normal way for cooking in rural areas, which is provide very bad and not healthy environment for cooking because they use the three stone cooking, which is having like, so if it, now it is outdoor, but sometimes it's indoor, so the smoke, and this is affect the health. So the cooking with biogas can save time and provide healthy cooking environment, like here, using biogas. This is one of the projects that applied to rural areas. So instead of cooking here, they are cooking in this burners using biogas. The second thing is that in the same time while we promoting biogas as the fuel, the biofertilizers coming from the digester promote home gardening. And so by promotion to home gardening, we provide like food security for the family. And also they can buy the additional, they have additional income by selling the rest of the vegetables. And this is here, we have different biodigesters, which is very simple. And it gets interesting of the rural area people, women with men, and here the difference between, here, for example, this photo is the right one is by irrigating by biofertilizer, and the second one without biofertilizer. And here they are planting different vegetables, and they're selling and also providing the family need. The third thing is cooking with biogas can stop using wood fuel. And this is the situation in the recent years, last year and the year before. So these people are not having any access to even for wood to cut. So they are moving from the rural areas to the big cities. They stay at the edge of the big cities in very difficult condition, access to water, access to electricity, and this become like conflict areas, and they are fighting for this one. And this is also caused the country to high deforestation rate, like 2.2% barrier. So the second role is to build real models and tell successful stories. So we are not only working in the laboratory because we need to reach people. So the first thing we made is that we installed a very fancy biogas model, which is real. So people didn't believe us. How come biogas or using my manure or the cow manure to produce gas? And this gas will not smell in the food? They ask like this. And they didn't believe that we can get light also as well. So we made like a real project at my university. And people until now, they come to see this one working. And this is here, the light also. This is my daughter. And so we're trying to bring all the community. So even the researchers from other universities, we encourage them to come. And it was launched in 2015. And I think it was a great job to do. The third thing is our role also is to create innovative solutions that are part of the community daily life, culture, and their usual business to avoid resistance to change. So if you come with different solution, they resist to change. Like, for example, having the modern toilet. After, I think one of the UN agencies support this project, and after they installed it, they use it as like a store for their stuff. So they don't want to use it because it is not part from their culture. So to avoid this, we tried with my research group to use the very simple material that available and to make it very easy to install, very easy to maintain, and very easy to operate for people. So we're having sustainability in the proposed solution. And the fourth thing is to develop strategies for communication with different stakeholders and build trust. So the building trust is not only with the funding organization, but also with the people in the community. So this group of kids are sitting here waiting for this biogas digester to be installed. And they were saying, according to one of my students, it is nuclear bomb. So they were afraid, what are you doing? So we need to build this trust first as academia, and always we use as NGO, national NGOs as a medium body to speak with the people as a community. The fifth thing that work in partnership, national, international. And we had very good international partnership and also partners in Sudan, inside the country. This is my colleague from Australia who used to come and give the knowledge, and also we stand up and we had access to information and up-to-date technologies and what is going on. And also we managed to have our own laboratory in biofuels, and this was also a very good and successful story. So the sixth thing is to bridge the gap with other stakeholders and create sustainable relation and early involvement with all other stakeholders. And I think since 2014, we managed to have national seminars, forums in the national level in three different states, like 17. We done different capacity building programs, exhibition, study visits. We even writing reports, of course, scientific papers, fact sheets, business models. Even business models we do just to convince the private sector there is, because they always look for money and how they got the benefit. So we try and also to convince them. And also we do statistics so we can give to the policymakers. And this was out of our capacity, but we think it is very important is get particular SDGs accepted by relevant government department and show how each can use the SDGs relevant to their work to provide a new focus and objective, and also to include information on SDGs and the overall aim in the school and university course curriculums, and when necessary, interpret, translate the wording of definition of SDGs so they make better sense in the culture and language of each country. And this all is just toward self-sufficiency and improve rural economics, so we interlinkage all the SDGs together, our few of SDGs together. Thank you.
Oh, well, what a big jump. Now I've seen how big the gap is and whether the 2030 agenda can really be achieved by the time that has been bound for it. I would like to invite our speakers to come up front, and we'll open the floor for questions right away, please. Do you have the mics? No, not for the floor. Okay, I will just take questions as they come. Please state your name, institution, or country, and to whom the question is for. Please, the gentleman at the back. Yes, it's you. From Tanzania.
Thank you to all the panelists. I have two main comments and observations. The first speaker who presented scientific contribution globally and indicated Africa is contributing only 2%. I don't know whether it was the first speaker or second speaker. Okay, first speaker, yes. My assumption is that these data or percentages evolved based on global publications. That's how they are making these percentages. In which case, I tend to say, yes, there is something hidden there, because much of the science is being done in Africa by scientists from the north, and publications bears northern researchers, so you take it there. So I would tend to think the scientific contribution from Africa is probably higher than 2%. And if it remains to be 2%, then I can't see how we are going to actually have an impact on SDGs implementation by 2013. It's going to be zero or retro impact. Having said that, if we agree that they know they are actually doing their science in Africa, I think there is an ethical and moral obligation that the first beneficiaries should be the originators of the scientific material. So the North has something to contribute to the origin of the scientific material they have. They can hit back against me, but that's my feeling. Now, the other comment I have is, yes, all the speakers raised limitations to SDG implementations. I've been in several meetings, same listing, poor governance, poor policies, weak systems, accountability, lack of responsibility. They are the same thing being raised here. My plea is, if we need to do good implementation, we need to move forward. Instead of raising the limitations, we should be addressing how to remove the implementation, not leaving it to a country level, but in a concerted approach, meaning involving everybody, not individual countries, to move forward. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yes, up front here, please. May I just remind the speaker to be short and sweet?
Thank you. I finished. Okay. I'm a Hungarian. And to explain the background of my question, I should also mention that I was a member of the Hungarian delegation at the Rio conference. I was the key negotiator in Johannesburg and many things. I'm not so important in that, but you will much better understand my question. So it's very important also for the scientific community to have a backward analysis. So actually we have now with us with this very special holistic program, SDGs, but it's not only SDGs, it's also a full-fledged program, including the SDGs. But let me remind you that already from the 1960s, there were already holistic programs called International Development Decades, many of them. There were many other programs like 1972, 1992, the famous Rio conference, there was also many things. It was also clear that there is a challenge not only for the policymakers but also for the scientists. Either we have a complex approach, like the SDGs, or like MDGs, you mentioned that, we now restrict ourselves and tell, no, it's too complicated the world, too many things, let us focus on several issues. There were eight programmatic ideas. So my suggestion, I'm very much interested in views. Let us see why the former holistic programs coming from 1972, 1992, 2002, Rio Plus 20 was a different issue. Why we could not fulfill them? What was the problem? Not simply the political will. It was also problems with the political will, not technology, not science. Why only we remind those restricted approaches like MDGs, much easier to focus, communicate, and so on. We have now, I am very happy with that, a very holistic approach because of the interconnections. Our colleagues from Finland also reminded how is important. So let us see what was the problem earlier with all the holistic programs from the middle of the previous century. And we may face the same problem now in a selective manner, we can achieve something like the energy related. Just the last speaker now, it was very good. There is an energy related one. So there is the same fear that we lose sight of very important elements, too complicated, too costly. So how you see that? Can we learn from the past, those failures? I thank you.
Thank you. Okay, the gentleman in the middle. And you next.
Shushanta Mitra from the Waterloo Institute for Nanotechnology in Canada, not in Belgium. And I saw the data about 60% of funding comes from industry. So I think we have to work with industry in order to meet that. And industry has the corporate social responsibility processes. So I'm wondering, is there a process in terms of creating a UN declaration that certain percentage of the CSR should be devoted in within their institutes or within the business process to work on this SDGs? Any thought on that process from the panelists will be appreciated.
Okay, thank you. We take one more here, and then we see if the panelists have any.
Tell me, please, what is the scientific base for the sustainable development? Thank you.
Okay. You have anybody that wants to make a comment, or shall we just proceed to other questions? Yes?
Points.
Okay, so let's move to this side then. The lady at the back there, and then you go next.
Oh, thank you very much. I'm Anna Maria Inzelt from Hungary, and I have a short question. I was happy you highlighted the importance of the innovation in the responsibility, and I like to ask you, what do you think our businesses and our societies can move from innovation to responsible innovation?
Okay, and the gentleman here.
I'd like to follow on about the topic of responsible innovation. My name is Gordon Dalton. I'm the chair of ICORSA, the International Consortium of Research Staff Associations. I'm also the coordinator of the RING project, a European-funded project called Responsible Research and Innovation Network Globally, with the major partner of UNESCO. So a question for Heidi Hackman. Thank you for a very clear presentation on the technology facilitation mechanism. You spoke about rigor. A second or, which I didn't write down, sorry, I'm embarrassed.
Relevance.
And then responsibility.
And responsibility.
So the RING project is doing a state of the art of responsible research and innovation and practices around the globe. And we're doing a survey and interviews of what is responsible around the world. And we're intending to embed responsible innovation practices in the SDGs. This will be the major output of the RING project. We're also going to be exploring the competitive advantage of responsibility to industry. If they adopt responsible practices, are they more competitive? And this might be then a driver for them. So my question to Heidi is, what elements of responsibility will your technology facilitation mechanism be pushing?
Okay, let's go to the panelists and see.
Okay, I can start. Okay, so I think many of the questions have some common themes, so I would like to comment briefly on them. The first thing I would like to say is that, yes, we do have an agenda, the Sustainable Development Goals, but other people have other agendas, and that's part of the problem, that we are not thinking of what other people are bringing to the table. So right now, there is a trade war. The trade war is not part of our discussions. We see riots in Chile, in Ecuador, in Bolivia, in Iran today. That is not part of our problem. People are worried about losing their jobs, and they see science and technology as a threat. That is not part of our agenda. If we want people to listen to us, I think we need to start by listening to them. I think we are preaching too much and pushing our agenda. Probably our agenda is very nice. Who doesn't want to end poverty and end climate change? But if we want to be realistic, we need to be aligned with what people worry about. There is a recession coming. and we are asking for more funds. There is more competition for big companies, and we're asking for them to contribute. So I think we need to align objectives and incentives. It's very clear, objectives and incentives. Just projecting our goals to other people is just not going to work in the same way didn't work in the past. So my suggestion, a very practical suggestion, is yes, we need a World Science Forum for scientists to discuss how we can be more efficient and practical about our agenda, not just about the agenda in general, but also we need to start thinking now multi-stakeholder approach when we invite all the key stakeholders to our meetings, because otherwise we are not only preaching to the choir, but listening to the choir complaining to the priest, I'm sorry, I'm taking this analogy, about why this is not working. So we need the people that actually can make the decisions. You were putting the question before the panel, you know, who is going to be paying, you know, how the North can contribute to the South. We cannot respond to those questions because we are not decision makers. We need this World Science Forum to be a much more multi-stakeholder with everybody's agenda is listened.
Do you want me to continue? Okay, thank you. There were many very interesting questions. I'd like to start with a short one, which was the agenda, what's the scientific basis. It's not scientifically based, it's a political agenda. And the role of scientists is to contribute to the implementation of the agenda. Of course, scientists were part of it, but there are many political compromises that were done so that it would be possible to sign it by everyone. So just shortly. I also would like to raise, I really enjoyed your view about these riots, and actually this links us back to the implementation part, that we should not talk about poverty and all the 17 separately, but they are all interlinked. And if we take, for example, the injustice that is growing, so the growing injustice is really bad also for the economy. And now there is lots of economic outputs that really show that actually it hampers the even economic growth, not to talk about sustainable economy. And it also hampers reaching out from poverty. So we really need to go out, we need to talk with the elites and have a dialogue with them, listen to them, have a dialogue also with those who are listening to the political decision makers who are pushing for single solutions to complex and to wicked problems. I will stop very soon, but I would like to start with the first questions about this 2%. And I do agree that it deals with the international journals that it looks for, and there is definitely national literature, scientific reports, and one of the recommendations of the Global Sustainable Development Report is actually to draw together all the not only scientific knowledge but also knowledge from other sources, how you can actually push the transformation forward. But in many ways, it is really the reality, because we also need to deal on a global level on these issues. And you raised a very important question. Who gets the first name on the papers? It's not the coordinator, but it's really someone else who is, in a way, leading the articles. And that's part of this open access and change of research in the developing countries. So I would love to say of the other issues, but I know we are short of time, so I'd rather give the microphone to someone else.
I would like for Heidi to kind of comment on the two questions.
So very briefly, thank you. Clearly, I'm sorry I missed your session on responsible research innovation. It was yesterday, right?
No, it's actually tomorrow.
Tomorrow? Okay, then I'll have to come and talk with you there. Suffice it to say that the issue of responsibility is not something that is being discussed in connection with the TFM, but
you know, freedom and responsibility is enshrined in the statutes of the International Science Council. We have a dedicated committee on freedom and responsibility. And the issue now is for us to re-articulate what we mean by freedom and responsibility of science. And it's because of the massive changes we're seeing in not only in society, but in the world of science. So for example, doing science in a digital age, data-driven science, the possibilities, the opportunities and challenges that poses for us as a community requires a re-examination, a re-articulation. So I can't answer your question, Gordon, but it is, and that's why the theme of this conference is so important. I mean, the other thing we need to reconsider in the context and given the urgency of the global challenges we face is the anti-science distrust in science, distrust in institutions context within which we're working. So in that context, as I said in my talk, what does it mean to be a responsible advocate? We've shied away from advocacy. Do we understand what we could do differently as advocates, as scientists? So these are very, very important issues for discussion. I think the other questions are interesting. So they have been addressed partially. I think the question of can we learn from history? Do we ever? But it reminds us not to go and reinvent the wheel. And I think this does pose serious challenges for us as a science community. So I love the entry points of the GSDR, the 6 entry points, showing us pathways, tractable pathways to interactive, sensitive, sustainable development. But you know, there's the World in 2050 initiative and the SDSN, who've at the same time published 6 transformations to sustainable development, and they're just slightly different. This is coming from people who are well connected and who work with each other. So it's not just reinventing the wheel, but as a community, also beginning to collaborate, partner with each other more closely, be more vigilant about that, and speak with one voice to the policy community would be extremely helpful.
Just a quick one. We took in the Global Sustainable Development Report approach from the very beginning that we want to be very open from the very beginning. So we really told all these plans that we had already 3 years ago. And the science is, someone mentioned in the morning session that science is very competitive, very individual. We told, steal our ideas and go out with them. And some were so that they did it. And I think it is just great. Someone gave a presentation just before me a couple of weeks ago and told about the report and stole all my words. And I was so happy. And I think this is the way, and this is a big change in science, that we should agree that we are doing something together.
Okay.
I just want to add that for Ferris' comment that we show the challenges that we face, but we also brought solution, but we are not the people that are able to implement the solution. Yeah, because we are not the people who are funding, we are not the people who are creating policies and maintain sustainable direction. But I think each country has some strengths that should be optimized. And this is how we look to each country. For example, my country is having our own strengths. So we need to build the capacity in the national level so they have to customize their solution and make real change and make real impact.
Okay, maybe as the moderator, I'll just take the right for one question, and I would like what would be considered the most important STI transformative path to realize the decade of action and delivery of sustainable development? The most important.
Can you make it simple?
So you're asking for an SDI moonshot. Let's make it possible to integrate data across the science disciplines.
Yeah, that was really fantastic. And the other one is that work in a very concrete level with different actors and take something in common that you work on, something very practical.
For me, it will be a global fund for science and technology for the Sustainable Development Goals. So it's not limited by country, but we can put a big pot of money from those governments who want to donate, so that gap between the north and the south that was mentioned is bridged. And also those companies that want to contribute can put money, chipping money, into the fund. So the best scientists from all around the world can respond to the call with ideas, very competitive, very well funded, and needs to be open source. So a global fund for science and technology for the Sustainable Development Goals. I'm an early career scientist. We go where the money is. It's very simple. The European Research Council has been very successful because it's granting $2 million or euros to those who actually get the grant, right? So why not make it easy for companies and governments in a big fund for global science and make it open source?
I think that would be fantastic and could really promote multidisciplinary type of collaborations that we really need. And then to the first participant's point, I think in really truly collaborating together and including all countries in our efforts and, you know, counteracting the dominance of the West is really important. So really including Global South as true partners in all of this.
Well, excellent. I would like on behalf of the floor to thank all our panelists, and let's give them an applause.